Today's episode of the Worn and Wound podcast is brought to you by the Zodiac Limited Edition Super Seawolf World Time Watch. Stay tuned to a bit later in the episode to learn more.
Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. My name is Blake Bettner and we are back in studio. I'm joined with Mr. Zach Weiss. Zach, hello. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And we have, I'm excited about our guest today. We've known him for a long time. You know him as the proprietor of a blog to watch. He is Mr. Ariel Adams. Ariel, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Blake, thank you so much. It is great to be here, and I'm really looking forward to talking about 10 years of watch blogging for you guys.
Ooh. 10 years of watch blogging. That's right. We are just kind of wrapping up. Well, this is our 10-year anniversary.
We're going to call it May to May. It's not quite 2021 because things are going to still happen a little into 2022. Yeah. That's
I mean, look, we sat down and talked about ideas for 10 years. None of them have really been about like us for 10 years. Yeah, they've just been like a good excuse to talk to people like you, Ariel, and friends of ours.
Do you think the watch industry has maybe made us mistakenly believe that anniversaries are too big of a deal?
That's a good point. Yes, as Zach likes to say, every year is an anniversary.
It is.
Hey, next year it'll be our 11th year.
Yeah, I know. It's every
it's like
5 years.
If a number ends with a 0 or a 5, a new watch has to be made. It's like a Swiss law.
Yeah, 100%. Just a watch. I mean, it's comical at times, especially when there's multiple anniversaries. So you're celebrating a watch, like a series of watches from a brand, and then their overall anniversary. And some watches are for different anniversaries within that same year.
Yeah, but, so I can't keep them straight. Hey, if it makes something cool, it's cool. Yeah. I like it. And I have some anniversary watches, I think, and I associate the anniversary with them. I just like the watch for what it is. What should we do for our 170th anniversary, guys?
Wow.
Oh, that's exciting. Maybe release a new Nautilus?
I was going with that.
Shows you what watches I think. I was like, 107. That's so specific. I'll be dead.
It's oddly specific. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But it would be so nice if somebody was celebrating like the 170th anniversary of our doings.
Yeah.
We're long since dead. None of our family members know, but like there's 175 years of Blake watches. You know what I mean? You never know what could happen.
I sincerely hope Worn and Wound is on the return of the 5711.
Yeah.
You know, in like puke green.
You can have an Easter egg with your name written in the back of it.
Perfect. Yeah.
That could be a show. All the most unflattering dial colors.
Yes.
Puke green. That's high on the list.
Puke green. Well, if you just call it something else, then, you know.
I think puke green is chartreuse, if you want to be.
Puke green, army green, chartreuse, yeah. Before we get into that, let's do a quick wrist check, as is custom around here. Zach Weiss, what are you wearing?
So I'm wearing a watch in for review, the Echo Neutra Averroes 39 moon phase. I think I have that right.
Wow. Okay.
I think I have that right. And it's a fun 39 millimeter. They kind of call it a field watch. It feels a little more piloty to me, by the way. It's in that kind of vein. And what's interesting about this is that it's a sport watch with a moon phase executed in a fun fashion.
There you go. That's a mashup you don't often see.
No.
I feel all these lines between the field, pilot, diver, they're all just getting like continually blurred these days.
I felt a need to try and identify which it is, and I feel like maybe that's my mistake. This is just a 39 millimeter watch.
Yeah, maybe we don't need to.
Sporty.
Yeah. And what kind of strap is it on?
That is on a Crown and Buckle Matte Supreme. The strap it came on, I found it didn't didn't find it very flattering, so I changed
it. It happens.
But yeah.
It happens. Ariel, what do you got on your wrist?
So like a lot of people out there, and I've noticed this a lot since I've been going to events, is I have been double wristing it for the majority of the pandemic. I have a smartwatch on one wrist and a watch that I've been wearing a lot lately. I've been really into, is the Moron Moussey Skeleton Armour. This is a really kind of crazy watch because it has a case that is water resistant to 300 meters without any gaskets. And the way does that is the metal fits together so God darn precisely that no water can go through between the cracks.
Interesting.
Which is, they call it a complication unto itself. And so they have a skeletonized movement that they made with Le Jeu Perret, which I really think complements the interesting case design, because some of their initial watches were like the dial didn't really match the case, but they're really sort of onto something now. And so this is one of those little up and coming brands. They're a little pretentious with the Swiss thing. They go by Swiss crafted, which means everything is made within 60 kilometers of where their manufacturer is. It's sort of like fun to see these activist brands are like, Swiss made's not good enough for me, you know, like Moser or something like that. So, you know, I like that nerdy stuff. And I also like that it's going to take 5 to 10 years for like the mainstream to ever know what the hell I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I honestly have no idea. This is the first time someone's been on the podcast. I'm like, I can't even imagine that watch. So I'm excited to look that up.
I knew it would be Ariel that would have a watch.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Like, what is it?
And I like, so it's all, it's just like their thing is tolerances. They just have the best tolerances.
They're
just,
okay, so they've been a supplier for other brands. Okay. You know how it goes. And then they're like, hey, we should do this. And then they come up with something, but they know watches and they know that they can't do what everyone else does. And these are micro mechanical engineer nerds. So for them, like, they're showing off something, being like, look, we can do a water-resistant case without rubber gaskets. Like, for them, this is a huge deal.
Yeah.
For everyone else, it's like, what are you adding? But from, like, a, you know, mechanical, metal-cutting, artistic standpoint, wow, this is just the bee's knees, right?
Yeah. No, that is super cool. I mean, I think people, you know, just to digress into a water-resistance conversation. But, you know, I'm sure you've gotten this article. People are always like, oh, if it doesn't have a screw-down crown, it's not really water-resistant. And that's more so like you don't screw it up right underwater. It's like the gaskets and the seals that matter. So the fact that they can even go a step further than that, go beyond the gasket.
Yeah, it's crazy. Know? And look, I think that it's so easy to get bored. I mean, look, you've been doing this for 10 years. I've been doing this for 15 years. People actually ask sometimes, I'm sure to yourselves as well, like, do you get bored of this stuff? And there are a lot of boring, redundant watches. So finding things like this, for me, it keeps me interested in the hobby.
We certainly appreciate that. What was the name, the brand name?
Morin Musi, M-A-U-R-O-N, second word, M-U-S-Y.
All right, there we go.
Okay.
Right.
Look that up.
We'll check it out.
I know, they have their name Moron in the title.
Yeah. So. That doesn't help,
I've got two watches on as well. I've got an Apple Watch on. I broke my other one, and they sent me this Series 7, so I've been just kind of checking it out for a while.
Oh, so that's the new...
It's a new Series 7. I normally just wear this when I'm, like, running or bike, like, doing something active, But I thought, you know, with it being a new one, I'd give it a week double wrist in or so and see how that goes. You forget how useful these things can be sometimes. I like not having to pull my phone out all the time to see what's going on. But on my other wrist, I have a Seiko SSC819, I think is this. This is a part of a quartet of the Mecha Quartz or
the Solar. Yeah, I don't think they're Mecha Quartz. They're just solar quartz
movements, chronographs that they released alongside those mechanical speed timers.
Yeah.
This was a few weeks ago, I think. Now, and these were kind of like a, oh, and by the way, release alongside those. I think the speed timers, we're all fine and well. They looked maybe a little less ergonomically practical on the wrist. So I think we were immediately drawn to these.
They're 39, right?
It's a 39. It's a really comfortable, reasonably sized watch. So we're putting this one through its paces, and we'll have something up soon on the site about this. Josh, what do you got on over there?
I got my Timex Q root beer.
Nice.
As usual.
looks great.
I just wore all those speed timers last night, actually. So
did
I
you? Exactly the mechanical ones?
Both of them, and the solar quartz ones. It was a very common thing, like, oh, the case is so thick. And then I had to explain, well, the movement's thick because it's actually a good chronograph and it doesn't wear out over time. And they're like, we don't care, it's so thick. I'm like, just wear it for a week, you'll be fine. So it's funny that there's this, like, used to be diameter, you know, hesitation. Mm-hmm. Now it's like thickness hesitation.
Yeah.
Just, you know, once you go 18 millimeters thick, there's just no going back.
Well, yeah, I think consumers are starting to become more, like, wary of what they like and what is comfortable for them, you know, whether it's big or small or you know, whatever it is. I think they have more information now, or at least have a better understanding of some of the dimensionality of these watches that people like us can provide for them to give them a better sense of, well, this is what it's going to be like on your...
You sound like people with sleeves.
Yeah, I have...
Oh, you're a California guy over here.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you live in California.
We have winter jackets
on these days. Sleeves make all the difference. Look, I was at Dubai Watch Week, and I ran into Fabrizio from Bulgari. He's the designer. And he had these like extremely fitted sleeves. They looked so good. They were like so perfect. And it's true. If he had anything thicker than the Octo Finissimo, it wouldn't have fit. Now, I never looked that good in a suit, but if I did, I could never wear a thick watch. It would look silly. I totally get it.
Yeah, yeah. So I met you when you lived in San Francisco, and that was...
Yeah, I remember.
That's a city that you need some sleeves in. This was a long time ago, though. This was, maybe 12, 13 years ago? Yeah.
Yeah, at least.
Wait,
if this
predates Warner went on, it didn't exist. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, this is off of Mission Street, I think. And we met and you were interested in getting in the watch industry and you had all these ideas and stuff. And you've done a lot. You've had a lot of roles.
Yeah, look at that. Look at us now. We've got, I was going through a bit of a Lumtech phase at that point.
Oh, yeah. Everyone starts with a Lumtech phase.
So I had a Lumtech on. Do you remember what you were wearing?
Wow.
Me? No, but I remember that Lumtech was the first ever company to send me a watch for review.
Look at that. All right. Shout out Lumtech. The boys in, Ohio, is it?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Back in 2007, they were the very first company, and I worked directly with Chris for a while. I have no idea what's going on with them right now, but we'll always remember them as the very first watch I ever got sent for review. It was the M something. I remember it now. It was kind of Panerai-ish.
Yeah, like M89. And they did these like tungsten cases, I think, and all kind of crazy.
They did all kinds of crazy. So again, I have no idea what they're doing these days. I hope they're still going strong.
Yeah.
Brands like that, what ends up happening is they tend to find this community of a few thousand buyers. And then they don't have to market anymore because those people just keep buying more of their products and the brand doesn't have to they don't want to grow. So it's a very interesting thing. We've seen this in the space where we help these brands get to a size. They're like, oh, we have all the customers they need. But then they just sort of like languish for decades.
Yeah, or kind of just iterate on like, okay, we've got this thing that works and people like it, and like, it's too risky to move off of it. So, we'll come out with new materials, new colorways, new dial executions or something, but it's too much of a risk to like...
Are you talking about Rolex?
Well, come on, I don't want to name any names, but are brands playing it too safe these days, do you think?
I think they're playing it as safe as they feel they need to take it. Watch brands are money-losing propositions. These are like vanity companies. If you have like a big portfolio of like money-making brands, your screw-off brand is the watch brand, right? That's your company just to like have parties and throw a bunch of money into and make gifts for your friends. But the idea that like you can be a publicly traded conglomerate or a big private equity firm and like pick up a watch brand to make money, well, we know that's just silly.
Obviously.
Oh, yeah, obviously. Yeah. What do you think, though, from the other side? Like, there's obviously, it's extremes, because then there is obviously the smaller brands that seem to be thriving and making good business.
Because you have to pump all the profits into research and development and marketing. So you have a Richemont, for example, that has to siphon off of the profits that, like a Piaget makes. And we know that to be competitive, nearly all of those profits need to be recycled back into the brand. And that doesn't happen when you have a stakeholder or shareholder of that type. And so from a business perspective, these brands can't go on autopilot. Like when Richemont bought Jaeger, they're like, oh, wow, this brand has all this cool history. As long as we just keep making this stuff, we'll be fine and we'll make money and the profit margins are amazing. But then they realize like, oh my God, we have to put so much money into the brand all the time and marketing and new products. Like this is insane. What the hell do we do? So that notion as a business model has essentially failed.
Well, especially nowadays, I feel like there's a lot of products, sneakers, they're on this like weekly drop type of thing where customers like have this expectation of something new all the time. Mm-hmm. Instead of like, okay, maybe like once a year you get together and watches, the watch brands have, here's our couple new models. And now I feel like there's a pressure to like all the time have something new to introduce.
We need a fix.
This is sort of good and bad for people like us. The sort of intense news cycle is actually a workaround from having to spend money on advertising. The idea is that you need to be on consumers' minds all the time. And traditionally, the best way to do that is to buy like billboards and radio advertisements and stuff like that so that you're on their mind all the time. When you have a new product, they've been thinking about you so often, they're like, I want to check it out. But what marketers have found is that you can bypass theoretically spending as much money in advertising and just release products all the time because people like us will be suckers and cover it and give them all that awareness that they so desperately desire. But then, as you said, they actually have to fulfill those promises and come out with those products and actually have them be satisfying, which is ridiculously hard. So I am actually a fan of the more traditional models, like just pay to be on people's minds and then get them excited about something new when you actually have something exciting. But just my perspective.
So, I mean, this brings up, like, we're moving away from you know, back when we started this, it was like the Basel World, SHH, and, you know, there's kind of these windows every year, and it seems to be they're kind of going away from that. Some brands are realizing, like, hey, we can own our own moment and we can create it. And, you know, Breitling does these summits, and there's things, I think, that our brands are realizing, hey, we can kind of take this into our own hands and kind of create the cycle that we want. And, you know, we don't have to compete with every other brand making a release at the exact same time as we are. So to your point, maybe it's not as important. Like every watch doesn't have to be a banger to like stand out in a crowd. Like they can just
it's
have
become
release.
Chaos though. It's become absolute chaos.
Yeah. Yeah, it has. Do you like how it is now compared to, you know, when you, all right, like when you make the trek to Basel World and then that's where you kind of see all the new releases, in SHH, or do you think this is a better way to do it?
It's an excellent question. It's definitely what's on everyone's minds right now. I, for one, have contended with the fact that I may never visit the city of Basel ever again, and I'm okay with that. Frankly, it's not really up to me, right? Market forces will have the industry experiment with all sorts of things before it stabilizes into any type of normalcy. And we're, I don't know, a decade or two away from normalcy in the watch space. So we're just sort of like a couple of little ships in a crazy ocean right now, which is the luxury watch industry. And we're just sort of along for the ride. So I have no idea what it'll turn into, but I think the watch brands themselves are the most exhausted at this point and the most understaffed. And what happened in the past with the big trade shows didn't work with them, it was too expensive, and what's going on now is too chaotic and insane. So something is going to change. We're just not sure what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. What, so you've been doing this a long time. You mentioned 15 years. Is there anything like, look, you know, back then were you thinking, all right, this is all heading kind of this direction. Like what surprised you? Like if you had told yourself back then, oh, actually this is what it's like now, do you think you'd have believed yourself kind of a thing? Like what's been the biggest surprise to you in the past 10, 15 years about this industry, watches, brands, people?
Wow. There's so many ways to answer that. I'm just going to sort of share an immediate thought that came to my head. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in Dubai recently and everybody was lamenting Basel World and talking about it. A lot of people saying horrible things. And I was thinking about me going to Basel World, and I went to Basel World 10 times. In a row. So that was sort of a good run. And I remember going some of the first times. You walk through there and you guys remember there's these big booths and these halls. It's larger than life. Mm-hmm. So much money is spent. And you ask yourself, you have to ask yourself immediately, does the industry really have this much money? Like, are there that many people buying watches out there? Like, is this industry as big of a deal as the industry wants it to be? And it turns out, no, it was kind of a lie, right? Mm-hmm. And my suspicions were correct back then. So I'm surprised to the fact that a lot of my intuitions early on about how kind of dysfunctional this industry is in a lot of ways was correct. And that, you know, it was sort of like a walking zombie in a lot of ways, where it sort of held on to tradition up until the point where it just stumbled over its own feet and fell on the ground. And the persistence and the interest people have in watches that has maintained has also surprised me. I mean, we all remember around the year 2000, there was like all these articles like babies born now will never have any idea what a wristwatch is. And that turns out to be so untrue. In fact, 15-year-olds today, because of pop culture, know more about watches than a lot of 35-year-olds, mm-hmm. right? And you actually have watches that are bigger part of watch culture now than any time in our lifetimes. And so that's also really surprised me that watches in one way or another have endured in a lot of ways, become more popular in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Smartwatches, that's a whole other thing that sort of surprised me. But mostly optimistic, but also a little bit sad that some of the traditionalists will probably die again. This is an industry of death and resurrection, as we know. Mm-hmm. And there will be names that we know that are going to be gone tomorrow that may be resurrected long after we're gone.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we often kind of like, I think we celebrate the parts of the culture around watches and watch collecting. When you think of like vintage watches that have this like, kind of really cool aspects to them that we laud, and they're rare and all this kind of stuff. Like, and I've recently written something about this on the site, but where do you see, like, what do you think the culture around watches right now, which is, it's very different than the culture around watches in like the 60s and 70s. Like, you know, is this going to be a healthy thing for people in another 50, 60 years from right now? And when they look back at this era, like, where the romantic stories and coolness, and or is it just like, you know, this watch got all these likes on Instagram and it was wore this on this celebrity, like, you know, is that important? Okay, like, who cares?
Yeah, yeah. Look, there's two ways to look at that. And I think it's both positive and negative. Now, so our experience is we have sort of this disassociated nostalgia from a time when watches were really instruments. Like, you had to wear a watch and they were used for all these important purposes. And we never really lived through that time, not in any real way, but like, we know people that remember it and remember it really, really well. And so our connection is to this certain nostalgic age of watches where they were utilitarian items. But what we don't have is a lot of documentation, a lot of organization. You know, a lot of the stories of vintage watches are sort of made up or lost, or we don't really know. And so we have to make up a lot of our culture as we go along, because, I mean, a lot of these watches, like, we make up the names for them, right? It's just some random reference. But if it wasn't for people today making up a name for a watch from yesterday, no one would care about it. Mm-hmm. Now we have this insanely rich, conglomerated amount of media, from what we do to social media to what the brands put out. When you look back on the sort of time from the early 2000s to whenever in the future, it's going to be this incredibly rich cultural experience from watches. Just think of the diversity of watches and the personalities and all this media we have to document it all. Future collectors will have so much more to work with than we ever had. And that's going to be very, very interesting, because I do think that we are living through sort of this golden age or contemporary golden age of watch collecting. I don't think 10 years from now there'll be nearly the proliferation that there is. A lot of the industrial complex that's still left over from the 60s and 70s and 80s is starting to die out. And you won't have this mass production of luxury watches in the way that you still have today. I do think that this is going to persist but become a lot more niche in the future. So we are going to be personalities whose statements are going to be studied and evaluated long after we're dead, but probably not in any predictable way.
I also think it's really interesting, you know, and kind of referring back to the jokes about anniversaries in the beginning, but, like, you know, already everything is referring back to something, like you're saying, from, like, this heyday. So there's a level of abstraction there already, and we're kind of reinterpreting the past, sometimes based on actual models, sometimes based on stories and images and, you know, sketches and things like that nature. So, you know, there's this, something's lost in the translation probably every time, whether or not we know about it or not. But with a lot of watches, you know, you can still grab the 50-year-old Speedmaster or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Another 50 years from now, that watch is in a museum or unobtainable entirely. It's a 100-year-old relic, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're only going to have these things that were like a halfway reference point.
Yeah.
And like, the abstraction is going to continue until, like, I mean, it's kind of funny.
It's
you look back at this. Yeah, it's telephone.
Watches,
and you look back at this era and you're like, this era just referred to that previous era.
Yeah.
So is the next era going to refer to the era that's referring to the, you know, like,
yeah, that's
so I hope it gets a little better. I mean, that's why, you know, every time we see something cool and interesting and new, it's like, bravo, like a new idea, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and I would love to see, I'd love to see more brands think about this, you know?
Yeah, I'd love to see with movements too. I mean, the movements are basically relics of the 70s too, at least the most mass-produced ones.
All right. All right. We've got, we mentioned the anniversary type stuff. Do you have any thoughts or any comments that you want to get out here about this watch?
Anniversaries?
About a certain anniversary watch from Patek Philippe this week.
Oh my gosh. Well, look, I don't think Patek is going to, you know, like me any less than they do. I've said some very unflattering things about them. Look, they make some great stuff, but I have to be a critic of the way these companies do business. If Patek Philippe was a publicly traded company, what they did over the last year would have been criminal. They said, I'm going to stop making a product, presumably right away. And then they continued to make the product while at the same time dangling around its value. The first one goes directly to auction. Again, if this was a publicly traded company and this was a regulated financial asset, this would be the biggest no-no that you could think of. Yet they're doing it as this sort of conservative, we make smart long-term decisions that are highly conservative, like a private Swiss bank, doing this type of thing. I mean, like, this is absolutely appalling to anyone who respects the brand of Patek Philippe. Where is Terry Stern? He doesn't seem like the type of person who would be okay with this. Who are the forces internally that are allowing this to happen? It's, you know, I understand that Patek Philippe has challenges like other brands selling their core collection. Mm-hmm. You sell a bunch of Nautiluses and Aquanauts, don't have the profit margins of the other ones. That's why their prices have to be increased. And then you sell a couple of grand complications here and there to some special collectors around the world. And everything in the middle, I don't know. I mean, how often are people excited about a Calatrava? They make fine watches. They've always been very, very expensive. But they're a multiple watch brand. They're not a single watch brand. And you have these issues like Audemars Piguet, where they become one watch companies. It seems extremely, extremely dangerous. Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Patek Philippe right now has some absentee leadership. The pandemic has done that to many, many people. And I think that this is a cash grabbery and doing some concert work with unscrupulous people that would not do things friendly to the consumer. And so what we see is a brand that I, as a collector, want to distance myself from.
It's interesting. I feel like I've seen kind of long-term collectors that collect Patek Philippe kind of two minds and some of them kind of sharing this sentiment of trying to distance themselves and then their collections mm-hmm. from this direction. Throw all that aside though, what do you think of the watch itself?
You're talking about the Tiffany one?
Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, I literally came out with a watch, within the last year with an aquamarine dial. I mean, I like the color. I made a custom watch with Tiffany with a Tiffany colored dial. So I have an actual Tiffany watch with a Tiffany colored dial. It's pretty. It's fine. I mean, it's something I'm demonstrated in the past I already like.
The Zodiac was very nice, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. But, you know, I feel that, you know, as a color, men can get away with just about anything these days.
This episode is brought to you by the new Zodiac Limited Edition Super Seawolf World Time Watch, a luxury timepiece based on the heritage Super Seawolf platform. Reimagined from the 1970s archives for the modern traveler, the World Time Watch has a water resistance rating of 200 meters and comes in two archival reissue colorways. Featuring the updated Swiss-made Soprod C125 automatic movement, a traditional universal Greenwich Mean Time tracker paired with a World Time outer ring and rotating bezel denoting 24 global cities, which allows you to track two time zones simultaneously. The limited edition Super Seawolf World Time Watch is where expert timekeeping and craftsmanship meet style and functionality. To learn more, visit www.zodiacwatches.com.
I remember years ago, there was a Chopard watch. It was the men's size, was 44 millimeters in pink. And I wrote an article saying, is this a men or women's watch? Because there's other than the color, it was completely a men's watch. It didn't have like, you know, elegant curves or something like that. It was a men's watch. So I have been on board with the bright color thing for a very, very long time. It's not for everyone. It doesn't go with everything. You want a black dial watch to go with your entire wardrobe, that's great. But if you want if you have a yellow watch, it's not going to go with everything. So, but we have watch collections, which is exciting. I don't know why a watch has to go with everything if you have a bunch of watches like we all do. So, I mean, if that's the question, it's cool. The color's cool with me.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't mind the color itself.
It looks pretty. I mean, it's a beautiful blue. It's famous blue. It looks a little bit like a Photoshop. Like it kind of, there's something a little unreal about it. I think maybe because
it makes
my
no sense in a Nautilus.
Yeah,
it looks like a movie prop. It looks like something from like Tiffany and Company, the movie.
Yeah, it is candy-ish, and like I guess for me, like you know, what is the actual price tag on that watch?
53.
Okay, so obviously it's gonna sell for whatever more, but like at $53,000, like. I'm probably not gonna, you know, it's probably gonna mean, I'd probably wear it, you know, I don't know. And like, in which case, like, I would probably go more conservative because it would be in my collection. That'd be all, I'd sell everything, then sink myself another $30,000 and then buy, you know.
Okay,
so it'd be
this.
My one watch. It probably wouldn't be
most
Tiffany.
Most of us were driving you know? The same car yeah. when this watch was $20,000 cheaper. Same exact watch.
Yeah.
Okay. So not too long ago, this watch was $20,000 cheaper, and for no particular technical reason, it jumped up this much in cost. I'm not saying that people aren't happy to pay for it and all that, but I'm just saying, like, let's just put things in perspective here.
Yeah.
This price is completely arbitrary.
Yeah.
I mean, they've done a lot of special things with Tiffany. They've had, the, you know, the relationship is there, so I don't think it's, like, out of line that they mm-hmm. did this. You know, I think the context around which they're releasing
it is... We're not judges. We're just deciding whether or not we as collectors want it.
Yeah. So just, you know, taking a step back even from that, just the kind of... the collaborations, the collaborative environment that we're kind of living in right now, definitely didn't seem to exist back 10 years ago. Do you remember what the catalyst of this was from your perspective?
It actually did exist. It just wasn't as public. You know, they weren't always touting, you know, I did this with this person.
Sure.
You know, everything from rap music to social media has always been about shared audiences in the last, you know, 15 or 20 years. It's probably the most effective way of getting new audiences is just do something with someone else and you sort of cross-pollinate audiences and everyone wins. This has been good business sense, and from a marketing perspective, it has proven very, very valuable. So I think that the publicity around collaborations is more important than ever. And I think what's great is that when done right, the products are amazing. So right now we're experiencing this wonderful array of experimentation where there's amazing collaboration watches and horrible ones. But like a few years from now, I think everyone will understand like the formula for a good collaboration watch. And I think it yields some really great products. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think some really awesome stuff has come out of it. You know, obviously the 1&1 stuff has been great. I think that a lot of them, though, I've got a few of them, I think, in my collection. I get excited about a lot of this stuff. And I think it gets back into that kind of like the pace at which things are moving these days just seems to be a little bit faster.
Yeah. I mean, what I like about it, I mean, other than the fact that we get to work with the brands and kind of have some creative, you know, role or influence and be part of that story, if even for like a small run of watches, is that sometimes we get to push the brands a little bit and do things that are fun. They're just like outside of what their normal aesthetic would be, but they kind of loosen the reins because, you know, they're working with someone else, you know. And I think about, you know, an old collaboration, one that maybe needs to be revisited or an article needs to be written, but like the Sin EZM1 Bathing Ape. Do you remember that watch?
Oh, wow.
Like that was so long ago. And he just like coated this whole Sin in camouflage, which I think rubs off. Like it doesn't, it's not very, but like Sin certainly would have never made that. Yeah, no, it's neat, right? And that was, I mean, that's like a epic streetwear brand.
Totally out of left field.
Yeah.
But see, that's what I'm saying. Like this isn't new at all. Like it had been done, it had been successful, and then they just sort of luxuriated it.
Luxuriate. I like that. We got to luxuriate ourselves.
Like made it okay to like put on Bond Street. You know what I mean?
I know that you collect watches personally. You have a passion for this stuff. How has your taste changed over the years? Are you like with the watches, the kind of watches that excite you that you want to put in your collection and that you end up holding on to for the long run?
Wow. I mean, this is like something that any of us could spend an entire like several hours talking about. I think that I've always been really attracted to tool watches. And so like a good, healthy, legible, durable, simple tool watch that's comfortable always has like a really big place in my heart. I always like wearing those on a regular basis. At the same time, I guess I'm flamboyant. So I like artistic watches that like are loud and crazy and weird. I do like, they do need to tell the time. They do need to be well made. But like for me, I have no limits on my desire to wear weird stuff on my wrist. Like I just, the weirder the better, okay? And I've also more recently become comfortable with design work. For most of my time as a collector, I was like, Ariel, you're not a designer. You have no business saying how a watch should look. You can critique it. You're a critic. That's it. You don't want to do anymore. But then I started to sort of become a little bit more comfortable with creative stuff and design work. I mean, all of us have probably designed a bazillion things that haven't been made yet. Sure. And I found it to be a wonderful challenge, much more difficult than it looks on the outside. You know, to make something nice, it's super, super challenging. And any master designer will say that to you. But I think it's sort of this wonderful notion that, you know, you can make something you want and other people can enjoy it as well. So it's really about giving back to the community. It's being sort of being part of the solution, like, oh, stuff is boring. Well, okay, make something cool. Well, I'll have to try and do that. I really want to make this hobby, you know, as sort of robust as possible for more people. So I guess like the next way to share my enthusiasm for watches is like we're all trying to do is be more part of the creative process and make watches that we and ostensibly others in the community actually want to own.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's fair, completely fair point. And it's interesting, especially considering your background. If I'm not mistaken, you have a degree in law, a law degree?
Yeah. We initially met about a block and a half from my law school.
How did that turn this was a blog to read at that point?
Yeah, I didn't know what it was going to be about for the first week or two. And I was like, oh, this is just going to be about watches. And then it was changed to blog to watch.
Yeah.
Look, I was into watches since college. That predated, you know, anything ever thinking about going to law school and stuff like that. And going to law school is amazing. I loved law school. I recommend it to anyone. It's a great education. A large percentage of the people that go to law school don't practice. I did for a little while. I mean, you know, as a business owner, you have to practice law for yourself, of course. But, you know, it allowed me to think about something very important, and that was communicating as a tool. Like in college and stuff, writing is like, oh, self-expression. But in law school, like, it's a tool to convey a message as clearly as possible. And I think that's really helped in the sort of formation of the ability to blog, which is I'm trying to write an article not for me, but for all you guys out there to know what I'm seeing, to sort of give you a vicarious experience. Like, I don't want anyone to know, like, what my personal journey with this watch is. Like, no one cares about that. They're like, what's it going to be like for me? And so I've tried to use my writing skills to communicate an interest in watches that ideally someone else might share. Because I think at the end of the day, you know, the loneliness of any adult life is that you want to have friends, and friends tend to have similar interests as you. So watches are a really powerful way for adults to connect and be friends. And for me, that is the sort of biggest overall social value. When people say, like, what are you doing to help the world? Like, yeah, on one hand, we're peddling luxury objects. I get that. But we're also helping to create a lot of connections and you know, make adult life better by still playing with toys.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to keep that in mind. Like, we're not doing heart surgery here or anything. Like, it's important to not take ourselves too seriously. And this is kind of like a glue to the social structure that we have kind of around our lives.
I think it's very important not to take ourselves too seriously. Like I said, and like, it's when people in our industry take themselves too seriously that I think they begin to come off like a bit of an ass.
That's not fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a slightly different perspective because this is our jobs. But I like to say this, you spend money on your hobby. You make money at your job. And so we are leaders of communities of hobbyists, right? Who do business with the industry. But if it's our job to be into watches as an enthusiast, that means we have a conflict of interest with hobbyists. And so I think that there's so many reasons of being into watches. People need to further segment themselves into why they're into it, because it's not enough just to be into watches. You have to be into it for the right reason. So I think that, you know, because there's so many different perspectives of why people get into watches and like talking about them, it's important to distinguish that so you're not with the wrong crowd and ideally not having fun.
I like to think of myself as a paradox in those terms as well. I'm just conflict. I'm conflict, yeah, self-conflict. Yeah, but no, that makes a lot of sense.
But I mean, do you, Ariel, like when you clock out of your job, if you do, like, do you still, like, is something that you still enjoy thinking about? Like, do you still kind of spend time on the forum and looking at discussions? And like, is this something that still consumes you as an enthusiast outside, like, even if you're doing something else as a job?
I would have absolutely no ability to do any of this if I lost enthusiasm for watches. If I simply started being not into watches, none of this would be possible. I couldn't sit there and write these articles.
Yep.
I still like watches very much. They still make me very, very happy. You know, sometimes I like brands more because I like the people there, and sometimes I like brands less because I don't like the people there. This is natural. But there's still so many cool watches all the time. I still actively collect. I still actively enjoy them. It's really still a pleasure. And like I said, you know, during the pandemic, especially, a lot of people escaped into their hobbies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, watches have been a great source of pleasure and companionship and connection for, you know, literally millions of people out in the world. It's really given a lot of people a good time when there hasn't been that many good times. So yeah, I'm still really into it.
So for the people that just discovered or got into this hobby during the downtime, maybe they're looking for something new to do with themselves. What are some of the brands that are maybe less obvious that you would point these people in the direction of?
You know, that's a really good question. And before I sort of mention what brands, I think about this weird advice I keep giving, and it's sort of like counterintuitive for us, but I do think it's good advice. And I say to people, like, when you start getting into watches, spend like at least a year, maybe even 3 years soloing it. Don't look at any discussions. Don't talk to anyone about it. Just go with your gut, go with your instincts, go with your own taste. Don't listen to anyone's opinion. Try out stuff. Some of it's going to suck. Some of it's going to be amazing. And then when you're armed with some experience and you feel like you have a personal radar on like what a nice watch is, then start to go socialize. I think that socializing while becoming a watch collector is actually a very bad recipe.
Yeah, that could be dangerous. I mean? Great. Yeah,
you know, a few months ago, you were pointing at Blake Benner. He was on a forum, and you were, some guy was talking about how his collection that he was just super proud of, and you were just like, that collection looked like it existed outside of the influence.
Oh, yes.
All these people, and it was kind of to your point, Ariel. I mean, even though he was socializing on forum, but it felt really like it was outside of all of the trends and everything else that.
It felt like this guy was in a vacuum and put this whole collection together and then discovered the internet.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And that was exactly my reaction. Like, I was kind of scratching my head looking at it, and, you know, none of them were really watches that spoke to me, but none of that mattered. Like, just how he talked about it and how he looked at every single one of them and was so kind of proud of what he put together.
Yeah.
Like, completely outside any influence from anybody on the internet, presumably. But I shared around that. We kind of had a discussion about it. Like, I like seeing that people like this exist out there.
It's amazing, and it's so refreshing when we find it. I run into these people as well from time to time, and it's like, wow, that is so cool. You know, it helps me discover things. I learn so much about contemporary taste. You know, I wouldn't want to get into any new hobby outside of learning about it myself anymore. Like, I am afraid of enthusiast communities selling it when I'm just sort of figuring out what I like. It's great once you're into it, no doubt. And, you know, a blog to watch has found out that we're very strong with people that have been collecting for at least 3 or 4 years. So it's sort of like people enter the hobby, maybe with TikTok these days. But if they stick with watches for, like, you know, more than 3 or 4 years, they end up with us, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's okay. I encourage that the brands market to young people, make sure, you know, I want them to get into it. I don't even want, like, our outreach to reach brand new novices. I just want us to reach collectors. We should just sort of have a larger goal of create as many collectors as possible and make sure that when someone becomes a collector, they don't get upset and do something stupid like try to buy Patek Philippe and say, screw watches.
Skip straight to the end.
It happens a lot.
Yeah.
Not good.
And I think it's okay for people that get into it to it's okay to make mistakes, and it's, you know, things are going to shift. You're going to learn a lot about, like, maybe a certain dimension that people make a big deal about on blogs is not a big deal to you, and that's perfectly okay. And I think that's a good example of it's easy to be kind of altered or
don't
or
measure
shifted.
Watches by their dimensions. We all know that there are watches that look unwearable on paper and are amazing on the wrist, and vice versa.
And maybe just delete Instagram. When you first start, I mean, you think, like, I feel like Instagram sort of, even like this whole Patek thing, like honestly, whatever. It's not a brand I personally care about, and I don't give a shit about the watch, and I have no emotion attached to the unobtainableness of it. And but seeing people get so upset about it in social media, it's just like, you weren't ever going to get it. Even if you were wealthy, you weren't going to get it. Like, it's like, so don't be upset about it. And then, and that kind of translates to, like, you know, some of our colleagues will launch something and people won't react to it. And then people get personally upset about it. It's like, this has nothing to do with you. Enjoy what you're just enjoy.
I think people just will, like, long to show that, like, I belong to this community and I have a point of view on this thing. And I'm, like, a person that has influence in this community of people, you know, and it's a little bit of, like, you know, puffing out the chest a little, you know, I'm somebody.
I guess, like, when I find myself starting to get, like, upset by something, then I've gone too far. You know what I mean? I mean, now, like, we're too invested in this. Like, I'm upset all the time, you know, so, you know, but I can't go back, but, you know, or it's things with the dimensions thing. So I love Instagram.
Does the anger that occurs in the hobby surprise you? I always remember years ago being kind of dumbfounded as to why are people yelling at each other on the internet because of a case size diameter, like 38 versus 40 versus 42 versus 44. Like, why does anybody care about that? Like, it's like pant sizes. It's like, there's no better size.
Yeah.
You know, like, what is this? And it's manifested in all different types of ways. I think the problem is that we need to introduce the notion that, yes, if you like watches, you have an ego, that's all of us, and you've attained enough money to spend disposable income on something that does nothing, yes, but you also need to be polite. And
of course,
manners really, really matter, and I think that there's not enough pushback when someone's been polite. You know, they're called a troll. No, if they're being impolite, hey, so great you like watches, you also need to be a nice person.
Yeah, Zach.
Yeah.
Come on.
guys.
Ariel, I asked this to Ben Clymer. I thought I'd ask you as well. The existence, or not the existence of, I guess, the place that something like Instagram has in our hobby. Net benefit or net negative in the long term?
again, I'm not like a judge. If I vote against it, Instagram's not going to go away.
Has it been like a negative, a positive or negative to you personally, like as an enthusiast and as a collector?
I don't use it as a collector. For me, it's a tool that has no purpose. It's the way Instagram is designed with watches has this weird manifestation where all it does is perpetuate the same five or six watches over and over and over again. It's a like engine, right? And so the idea is like, people like this Rolex, then we'll give them more of the same thing, which is this Rolex. Instagram is not incentivized to help people discover new opinions or new products or new brands. We're better at that. Yeah. And so Instagram business model doesn't facilitate watch discovery, even though Instagram touts itself as being a discovery tool, which is complete BS.
Yeah, well,
so
that was very
I think that's fair.
If you are sharing watches of your collection with friends you already know and you want to have sort of a micro community, similar to how people have like WhatsApp groups, Instagram can be an interesting social tool. Hmm. But as a place to learn, get information, things like that, outside of, you know, brands being able to advertise to you, it has extremely limited utility in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's fair. I think that's totally fair. Mm-hmm. Do you, 100%. All right. So, and we can kind of wrap this up on this. Who's doing stuff out there that you are excited about right now that you think more people should be paying attention to? Like what brands, what watches?
I'm going to go to the heart of the industry's issue, which is basically distribution and sales. The variety of watches out there is going to be what's really at the heart of there being a market. You and I are both going to disagree on what's exciting, and it should be that way. Diversity has to be there for these things to be interesting to multiple people. But the problem is there's no established strategy right now for selling watches in the internet era. We know that people are learning about watches online first before the real world, and sometimes even more or less making a decision. But oftentimes they need to have a real world experience to maybe make the decision to get that watch. Maybe they just need to see it on someone's wrist. Maybe they just want to buy it in person. So it's an internet first place. There's a real world component, and the industry does not have this sort of like strategy. Like back in the day, they're like, okay, you sell a bunch of watches at department stores and they're going to sell to people. And that's what we do. Okay. There's no department stores that do that anymore. People have to sell direct to the consumer. Retailers don't create markets. They just sort of satisfy demand. These brands need to create their own demand, and they don't know how to do it in a way that they feel that they can afford, because they all hate marketing and advertising bills. So they're trying to figure out a consistent way of saying, if we spend $100,000, we make $200,000 or whatever. And that model doesn't exist yet. Because remember, these are run by like bean counters, right? We've met these decision makers. They're just finance guys.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, tell me how to make money. Well, we don't know. That's like saying how to make a nice watch. Well, try a bunch of times. Eventually hit onto something. The guys from the Swiss business schools hate that answer.
Yeah.
They're like, wait a minute, we have to take risk? No, no, no. So I think that we need to look at the fact that there is no way that a brand like, let's say, Omega can say, this is going to be our strategy for selling this, you know, $1 billion worth of watches a year, mostly online. This is our strategy that works. That doesn't exist yet. So all the innovation that matters right now goes into that model where brands that have corporate parents feel comfortable that I'll spend this and I'll make this amount. I don't know what that's going to look like, but when there needs to be, you know, more evolution of watch retail online, a better understanding of what the consumer demands are, less manipulation. The more you manipulate the market, the more you're just asking for a bubble to burst.
Mm-hmm.
Market manipulation, by definition, means you're going against the market. If you just go with what the consumer wants, there's no bubble that will ever burst.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So we need to find things that are not schemes and get rich quick mechanisms to sell watches in a consistent way that the companies feel comfortable that they're doing business as normal, or we know what our 5-year outlook is going to look like.
So my NFT watch store in the metaverse isn't a good idea.
You never know. You never know.
That's it. All right. Well, all right. What's the last watch that you had on your wrist that you thought, ah, boy, I like this?
Oh my God. Well, I just went to Dubai Watch Week.
Yeah. Anything good there? Anything?
Oh my God. I mean, so many watches I wore that were $1 million plus. All kinds of crazy.
Regardless of price, though, what was the last watch you had on your wrist that you thought, boy, this is, they're on
like
something.
Like that, you're like, you know what, I might have to add this to my collection.
Yeah, that you were excited about.
Okay, I'm not going to deal with the I not need to add that to my collection part because these are all watches that I have no business ever thinking about for you. But I was with Hublot, and I love Hublot because also people don't like Hublot until they wear Hublot, and they're like, oh, this is pretty cool. I was with Ricardo, the CEO, and he pulled out their all sapphire crystal watch that comes with a sapphire crystal bracelet as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I've never thought I would ever say this, but wow, I'm wearing a chandelier on my wrist. It was the weirdest and most amazing thing. It's their in-house automatic tourbillon movement. The thing costs like $433,000. Okay. And I'm like, Ricardo, will this break if you drop it? He's like, yeah.
But it works. Huh?
That's cool.
But it's so cool to wear it because, you know, like diamonds have that wonderful like sharpness of the facet.
Mm.
Well, sapphire, when cut, has that same thing.
Mm.
Like those edges are so precise. It's like wearing a watch made out of jewels. It's so nuts.
I remember getting the release for that watch a while back and opening a picture and just kind of staring at it for a while because it kind of breaks your brain a little bit looking at it. I can imagine.
It'll never work well in
photos.
It'll
put a smile on your face that like remind you that this is a great hobby for the ultra wealthy all the way down to people that just want a cool timepiece.
Yeah.
Just like, here's something that succeeds on its transparency. So here's a great background.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, cool.
Gotta have an attractive arm.
Yeah, that sounds very cool. I actually, you know, speaking of Hublot, they did some beautiful ceramics colors this year. Like there was an aquamarine kind of a thing they did. Yeah. Or like, I don't know, Miami summer.
The yellow
summer,
is
big
crazy. Yeah. It's so bright. The yellow and black one.
Yeah. It looks
so freaking cool.
Those look beautiful. I mean, the watch design itself a little more ornate than I would go for, but
maybe we need to get one of those in there and give her a shot.
Watch.
Give her a
you view. Know what? You're going to be designing a big bang for yourself in a couple of years. You're going to do the limited edition.
You heard it here first.
You might even be a brand ambassador.
Book it. The Hublot X Worn and Wound Big Bang.
Big Bang.
Designed by Zach Weiss.
Oh, jeez.
All right.
No, it would look cool. These are,
I would have some fun,
thing.
Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. All of this stuff is possible in the upcoming future. None of this stuff is off the cards. All we need to do is have some imagination and make sure the community understands what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If Zach wants to do a Big Bang watch, just say, this is how I'm approaching it. I'm someone that maybe didn't traditionally like it. I wanted to make one for me. That's a story that people will buy.
That makes it more compelling, I think. Yeah.
There you go. I get bored someone with ping you below.
Yeah. Ariel, you've been too kind with your time today. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been great
talking
to you.
Absolutely. My absolute pleasure and happy 10th anniversary.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. So you can catch Ariel at blog2watch.com. I believe you have a podcast as well.
Yeah, I do a few podcasting things. My current show is called Superlative, where I do an interview show. Have to have both you guys on at separate instances. Please come, which has
absolutely.
Been fun because we do. It's really a show about the personalities behind the industry. It's not like a watch nerd conversation. It's like what makes the CEO's minds tick of these brands. It's been really, really interesting for me, and I hope that. Again, in 60 years from now, it's going to be a testament as to who is behind this stuff. And then we have our social media presence. So, yeah, thank you so much for the plug.
Yeah, of course. All right. Well, thank you for listening out there. If you have any comments, leave them down below. We'll forward them on to Ariel. And thanks for listening. Until next time, take care.